My name is Phil Perazio, and I'm a urologic oncologist, a surgeon. Like many of you, I absolutely love what I do, and I would not choose another profession. But I have struggled with professional identity, practice efficiency, and wellness over the years. Operate with Zen is a podcast designed to explore a mindful approach to surgery and to being a surgeon. By discussing these struggles and mindful solutions, I hope together we can create a community of strong and healthy surgeons. Enjoy. Welcome back to Season 2 of Operate with Zen. As we said in the prior episode, we're going to talk about effective decision-making this season. And while we said we're going to do it in three parts, it may actually take a few more episodes than that. So today we're going to start with how to make strong decisions as an individual. And when we think about medical decisions, there's often a balance between the logical and the probable. And choosing wisely between the two is often key. So when we think about how we make decisions and how our brain works, causes, or what we perceive as causes, often trump statistics, even though in medicine we like to think of ourselves occasionally as above that. And this is really reflective of our system one versus system two learning again. And when we think about it, system one insists on causal interpretations. Remember, this is our quick thinking mind. What we see is what there is, and that's what we interpret quickly. Where system two is challenging and time-consuming, it is what is required to learn and comprehend new information. So based on that system one quick learning, we often see stereotypes to predominate our thinking. For instance, we all think that tall people will have taller children. But in fact, if you look at the statistics, tall people are actually more likely to have children that are smaller than themselves, as kind of a population-based height will regress to the mean. And we perpetuate a lot of stereotypes in medicine. There are certainly stereotypes about diabetic patients, about cancer patients, patients from certain backgrounds, patients who have certain professions. And we definitely, as surgeons, many of us have heard the stereotype of who's more likely to have complications. If they work in the hospital, if they're a physician or they're a lawyer, they're more likely to have complications, which certainly perpetuates stereotypes and not necessarily fact or statistic. So what we commonly perceive in medicine as causal learning rather than statistical learning is what we all refer to as N equals one, right? We've all had this experience where we have a really strong patient experience or the most recent patient experience, and that is often what drives our next decision. So there's a fair amount of science and studies behind this, and if you're really interested in this, once again, I'm going to refer you to Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow. But one of the studies highlighted in that book is by Nisbet and Borgita, who studied psychology students and presented them with statistical facts, and the students learned very little. However, when they presented individual cases to highlight a fact, generalization was often inferred, and there's a great quote from that study that says, "Subjects' unwillingness to deduce the particular from the general was matched only by their willingness to infer the general from the particular." And this particularly implies to medicine. We can all think back to our medical school days, our residency training, and even now, as we're fully functioning physicians, where we often learn more from our patients than from a textbook. How many of us struggled with pulmonary physiology or renal physiology, and we didn't understand the data and the facts and the statistics until we met a patient that helped us cement those concepts? And that is the tangible understanding of system one versus system two learning. We can only refer to the facts and the statistics so much until it's ingrained in our brain. And in general, humans are poor at making summary judgments of complex information. And we often make that summary based on the context that we are in rather than the fact, which is just a nice way of saying that that patient, that experience is what helps us remember rather than the words on the page or the numbers. So how do we get beyond this N equals one learning? How do we get on to better, more effective decision making? Well, I mentioned Aristotle in season one and the three kinds of work he put forth: theoretical work, where the end goal is truth; practical work, where the end goal is action; and poetical truth, bringing forth. And this is really what we're striving for. We're trying to bring forth good choices. So another great book for anybody starting a job is called The First 90 Days by Michael Watkins. And it really talks about a lot of business strategy and how to kind of implement that. And that's not where we're going to go. He puts forth three pillars of self-management, which is really applicable to very broad fields, including business success and leadership success. But the first is to understand success strategies. These are principles of communication, decision-making, and pitfalls. And this is where we're going to spend some time today. The second of the pillars is personal discipline, being able to set boundaries, being able to say no, focusing or in the end identifying our priorities, separating ourselves from emotion, and moving forward. And then the last part is creating support systems, both at work, at home, in personal and private life. These are our trusted compatriots, our trusted advisors who can help us navigate through decisions. So we're going to start with successful strategies and how can we understand them. So briefly, the first thing we have to understand, choice architecture exists. Now this is another phenomenon from the business economics world. And I'll give you another piece of reading here, Nudge by Richard Thaler and Cass Sunstein. And the basic premise of this book and multiple books in this arena are that there's a false assumption that humans make choices with their best interests in mind all of the time, and a false assumption that it is impossible to avoid influencing those choices. And in fact, we don't, and our choices can be influenced by a number of design factors, just the way we interact with data or the way we interact with choices. And if you're skeptical of what I just said, think about the products on the end of your supermarket aisle. They're put there for a reason. They draw your attention to them. They bring your attention to sales and high-volume products that you are more likely to buy. Think about all the opt-in versus opt-out choices you have in your life, whether this is for your benefits at work, for your credit card statements being electronic or mail, organ donation on your driver's license, and think about how many emails and spam emails you get on a daily basis because you didn't opt out of receiving those. And lastly, in medicine, I think we have a real opportunity to change the way we practice by shaping the way our guidelines and statements are structured, recognizing that by the way we design or architect these statements, we can influence each other's behaviors. So first, recognize that architecture exists and we can influence choices, and our choices can be influenced by the way they're structured around us. The second is to recognize that our emotional state certainly influences decision making. Simply said, frowning and sadness actually engages our system too. It is a more thoughtful, reliant process, where smiling and happiness actually engages system one. It's a little more natural and fast thinking when we're in a happy state. And emotional arousal is controlled by the amygdala, and it's activated when our decisions match our emotional frame. So when we're in a good mood, if we're making easy choices, it becomes easier to make those choices. Whereas if we are down or in a sad mood, it is harder to make a happy choice. The anterior cingulate, which controls our conflict and self-control, is activated when a natural choice is not taken. So if A to B should naturally lead you to C, but you're not making that choice today, you're choosing D, the anterior cingulate will fire up, making you aware of the conflict created by that decision. And lastly, the frontal brain, what makes humans humans, fires up when we have discordance between our emotional state and our rational thought process. And that's what helps us gain control over our emotions, or helps us process the logic, or helps us process the probable. So when we think about how this emotional state influences our decision making, in general, decision makers will take a sure choice, not a gamble, when outcomes are framed as good or positive. We will tend to reject a sure thing and take a gamble when outcomes are framed as negative and moral feelings may be attached to that description more than it's attached to reality or self. And I'm going to give you examples to understand what I'm talking about here. So when we think about, I'm a cancer surgeon, when we think about describing cancer outcomes or choice of options to our patients, if we frame the options as good, decision makers are more likely to choose the sure thing. So if we say your success rates for this surgery are 95% or higher, patients are much more likely to choose the sure thing, what we're describing. If we framed it another way and said, you've got a 5% chance of having a major complication or not being cured by the surgery we're recommending, they are much more likely to take a gamble or choose something other than the sure choice. And we also have to recognize that each one of us carries bias into these conversations. Each of our patients carries emotional bias into these conversations, where the word cancer may bring up huge feelings for one person as opposed to another person. Complications, deaths, or good outcomes may generate much more, or may generate different feelings for us than it does for our patients. And so these are just some examples of how we can consider those successful strategies when we're thinking about our pillars of self-management. The second area of focus is on personal discipline, and this is really in defining what is our priority, what are our priorities beneath that, and how do we say no? Greg McGown's book, Essentialism, really breaks this down into a very meaningful and simple task. If you break down your most inspirational and concrete goals, that is your essential intent. It is inspirational, concrete, meaningful, and measurable. If he says, if you could only pick one thing to be truly excellent at, what would it be? And this is where you should devote most of your time and energy. So why don't we say no? Well, we're worried that we may miss out on the next great thing. We're worried about rocking the boat, pissing off our boss or our colleagues, or burning bridges with others. But saying no is really a key to a process of elimination to get us to those goals. And instead of worrying that we're going to miss out on a great opportunity, it helps us choose and create the great opportunity that we want. And there's a concept called opportunity cost, which says that something must always be sacrificed to accommodate new commitments. And that is true, but we can help define that cost and have more control of it by choosing what we say yes to and choosing what we say no to. It's really hard to say no, though, because often we are saying no to people, to our colleagues, to our bosses, to our friends, to our loved ones. And we have to be able to separate that, once again, recognizing the emotional decisions that we talked about in that first framework of understanding how decisions are made, and saying that when we say no, we're not saying no to the person. We're saying no to the request. And good leaders will recognize that it is not a personal affront to say no to them. But poor leaders will make it personal, can hold a grudge. And so we need to think about that as we develop into leadership positions to not hold grudges on those who say no. And in fact, we should respect them for making a wise decision. So there are lots of ways to say no. Sometimes the simplest one is to just give space. Most often, if we're engaging with a boss or a colleague who wants us to do something, if we don't respond or reply immediately, we're implying that there's a decision-making process going on here. We're giving feedback by not responding immediately. And sometimes it's easier to say no after a period of contemplation than it is to say it right away. There are a variety of other ways to do that. Once again, I'd recommend Craig McCown's book if you want to get more into how to say no, but you can. Now, Ella Bhatt, who was an Indian activist, has a wonderful quote about choosing and saying no. She says, out of all virtues, simplicity is my favorite virtue, so much so that I tend to believe that simplicity can solve most of the problems, personal as well as the world problems. If the life approach is simple, one not need to lie so frequently, nor quarrel nor steal, nor envy, anger, abuse, or kill. Everyone will have enough and plenty, so need not hoard, speculate, gamble, hate. When character is beautiful, you are beautiful, And that is the beauty of simplicity. So how do we get to simplicity? How do we get to being efficient? First, don't be afraid to cut your losses. There's a number of biases, something called a sunk cost bias. Because we've made an initial investment in something, we have to carry it to fruition. Or because we always did it one way, we have to do it that way again. That's called status quo bias. It is more important to admit to making a mistake and moving forward in a positive direction than continuing to move forward in a negative direction. We can edit or condense our lives. It doesn't mean that we're doing more with less, which is sometimes the connotation with editing, but it means we're having less waste. We're being more efficient. And most importantly, we have to set boundaries. Many people think of boundaries as constraints that get in the way of your life. They stop you from doing what you want to do. But in fact, you need to change your frame of mind. Boundaries can actually protect your time, free you from the burden of having to say no. If you set up with your colleagues that you're not answering emails after 6 p.m., then they're not going to send you emails after 6 p.m. and it will facilitate efficient conversation during the day. Same thing with patients. There's nothing wrong with giving a patient your email or cell phone, but if you answer it at 2 o'clock in the morning for non-emergent or urgent reasons, you can certainly expect more phone calls at 2 o'clock in the morning. You have to set boundaries. It keeps you safe, protects you from the burdens of having to say no. Similar to boundaries are buffers. And this is basically planning for the unexpected. One of the most common things we see with surgeons is the planning fallacy, right? We underestimate how much time it takes to do something. And in fact, it's often about 50% of the time. And we all know colleagues and surgeons who do this. Oh yeah, that case takes 3 hours. Well, about 4.5 hours later, they're wrapping up, right? About a 50% fallacy. Oh no, I'll be there in 20 minutes. Guess what? Half an hour later, they finally show up. It's remarkable that this 50% is pretty accurate. So in your own life, give yourself a 50% buffer on everything you think you're going to do. And guess what? If you finish early, you've now have found time to do something else you didn't think you were going to be able to do that day. And plan for small wins rather than a huge victory. Lots of little successes will help build a culture of success in yourself, in the people you work with, whether this is in the operating room, whether this is in your academic career, whether this is in your practice with your colleagues. And remember, recognize people's achievements. The two primary motivators for achievement are giving people goals and then recognizing them for achieving those. So if we set small goals and recognize small wins, we are building a culture of success. And importantly, not only is this applicable to our colleagues and the people we work with, but this is applicable to ourselves. If we set small goals, we achieve small victories, we are building a sense of success in ourselves. And matched with self-confidence, this is a very powerful tool. And I've talked about the beginner versus the expert mind in multiple podcasts. And this is really one of the dichotomies that we need to work through to make effective decisions. The beginner's mind is open to many possibilities, where in the expert's mind, there are few. We need to use our expert minds. That's what we do. We were trained to be experts as physicians and surgeons. However, we need to choose the times where we need to be expert, and we need to open our mind to the other possibilities in times of uncertainty or challenge. This will help us be efficient. So to summarize here, our brain is organized to facilitate learning by experience, so take advantage of it. Whether you're thinking of your N equals one learning, how do we move beyond that? Whether we're thinking of choice architecture by the way we organize our choices or the way choices are given to us. And lastly, that emotion certainly influences our choices. So we need to understand that to be able to integrate when to include emotion into our choices, but also when to take emotion out of the choices. Most importantly, to create discipline and especially to say no and create simplistic essential goals and outcomes that we want to achieve on a daily basis, a weekly basis, throughout a career or for life. So I'd like to thank you for listening. In the next podcast, we're going to try and give some more concrete examples of good decision making through a wonderful book called 7 Ways to Think Differently. We're going to try something new next time, and I hope you enjoy it.